Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my guest co-host, back in time for the Masters, Andy Samarick.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm well. How are you doing, Andy?
Cannot complain. Beautiful weather. It's Masters weather.
It is Masters weather. So, Andy, it's been a little while since you've been on the show.
It has been a while.
And we've missed it. Listeners enjoy having you here. Rick has been around lately, so that's why you haven't been on. But you know where Rick is this week?
Well, I kneecapped him, so he couldn't be here because I wanted to be back.
Nice. No, Rick is working hard. He's in New Orleans.
Yeah. Working hard.
Yeah. How much work do you think that Rick's getting done down there, huh?
No one can get work done there, least of all Rick has.
You know, Rick's working on a couple of projects for us, and, you know, we're kind of concerned about timelines and, yeah. Knowing that Rick's in New Orleans, supposedly in his hotel room working away on our projects, Rick, if you're out there, no Bourbon Street, buddy.
That's
hit the books. We got timelines, deadlines.
What are the chances of that?
All right. Well, Andy, we have a special Education Gadfly Show today. We have decided.
We do.
That's right. We're going to have a special Pardon the Gadfly. Now, usually we would debate three topics for a couple minutes each, but big news this week. Of course, the president released his Elementary and Secondary Education Act reauthorization plan, and Andy and I disagree quite a bit about that plan.
We do.
So we're going to spend the whole Pardon the Gadfly hashing it out on that. I think that's going to be a lot of fun.
I don't know if it'll be fun, but
it'll be something.
It'll be good. Something.
All right. And then, of course, we've got Amber's Research Minute, and Stafford will rate that reform. So let's go ahead and get started, Mickey, with our special one topic, Pardon the Gadfly.
What up, Mickey?
What up? So a big policy shift in the new proposal is that the feds will fundamentally back off from intervening in schools. Instead, the best schools get prizes and flexibility, and most schools just have to take mandatory tests and adopt college and career standards to get their money. Andy, you wrote that you're conflicted about the new proposal. You like the fact that the federal government will take a less prescriptive role in managing schools. At the same time, you're concerned that the states will continue to fail if left to their own devices. Mike, you wrote that the new blueprint is a, quote, blind man's elephant the GOP should embrace. You're happy to see the feds out of the work of micromanaging schools and into the work of high-quality common standards and tests. Mike, why don't you start us out? What makes this proposal different from the ESEA of the 1990s and before?
Whew, Mickey, what a nice intro. All right, so let's get started. Let's get started with the big picture stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have been arguing here at Fordham for many years for what we've called reform realism at the federal level. That is trying to say, look, we want to push for reform from Washington, but we also have to be realistic about the limits of what the federal government can accomplish. So we'd like to see a tight, loose approach. That means tight about the expectations that we have for students, what they should know and be able to do, loose about how states and school districts get there. We think that No Child Left Behind had it backwards. It was completely loose as to what kids were expected to know and be able to do. That was left up to the states, as was the definition of proficiency, but all micromanaging about timelines and processes. You know, to the deadline by 2014, defining AYP, cascade of sanctions, on and on and on. So we wanted to flip all that. And what we're excited about is that, by and large, that is what President Obama and Arne Duncan have proposed to do. They have said that we're going to put a lot more emphasis on getting states to adopt common standards that are at the college and career ready level. And then, except for the very worst schools in the country, we're going to back off in terms of accountability. The watchword from the federal focus is going to be transparency instead of accountability. What they are admitting is that we are not going to fix the education system from Washington. We cannot expect this law then to push most of America's schools forward, per se. Some people will say that's raising the white flag. I say that's acknowledging being more realistic, being more humble about what the federal government can and can't accomplish. And then it goes back to the states to take their rightful role in pushing school reform for the 90-95% of schools that aren't targeted under this.
Okay, so the first thing I have to say is that as Mike celebrates making the great case for the Obama administration, so first, I always have to talk people down when they talk about how prescriptive NCLB was. The truth is, NCLB didn't set national standards, it let states do it. It didn't create tests, it let states do it. It didn't
I know, that's the problem.
It didn't set AYP. It lets states do that.
Oh, I should be quiet.
All it said is that you have to... So what it told states and districts is, listen, you come up with tests, you come up with your standards, you decide what cut scores are, you decide what AYP is, but darn it, once you decide those things, educate all your kids well. But the more worrisome thing to me is you, among others, wrote years ago that there was a big national consensus that NCLB came about for a reason, that we realized that there was an achievement gap, and it just wasn't in some of our schools, it just wasn't in the worst schools. This was something that was affecting all schools all across America where there were disadvantaged kids, and the national consensus was we had to do something about it. So we can't ignore the fact that since 1966 we have known that poor kids don't do well in schools because schools weren't doing the things necessary to bring them up to high levels of performance. And in that pre-NCLB era, it looked a lot like the post-NCLB era that the Obama administration is trying to put together, where states and districts have control, where they get to decide all of these different things and the federal government has a hands-off approach. The truth of the matter is when they had all that control, which conservatives like me should like, they didn't do such a hot job. So all of this happiness that the feds are going to be less prescriptive, it's hard for me to get excited about that because I know what that looks like. And that's a lot of kids not doing so well.
Okay, so a couple things, Andy. So first of all, it's hard to argue that the poor minority kids are doing dramatically better in the No Child Left Behind era than they were before. I mean, we did see strong gains, especially towards the late 90s, for poor and minority kids and low achievers, a real spike right at the end of the 90s. Nobody can quite explain it. It has continued to some degree under No Child Left Behind. Mm-hmm. But most people, I think a fair case can be made that, look, that was about standards-based reform, and that started at the state level in the 90s, and then NCLB nationalized it. So that's fine. What's different, though, why is this going to be different than before? There's still going to be annual testing in grades 3 through 8. Those scores are still going to be broken down by all the racial groups and other groups. Mm-hmm. So there's still going to be a lot more transparency than there was back in the 90s. But on the other hand, you're not going to have all the unintended consequences, putting all this pressure on the results of these tests that lead you to narrow the curriculum, that lead you to ignore gifted kids, that lead to this myopic focus on just getting a slice of the population above one low bar on reading and math tests. I mean, this will now allow local schools or districts or states to have a more nuanced approach that says, okay, let's think about that average school in the middle. How should we label that school? What right pressure, incentives, et cetera, from the state or district level can we use? And let's try lots of different things so that it's good for the poor kids, it's good for the minority kids, and it might be good for the other kids in those schools too. It's not just math and reading, it's all subjects. Let's have some nuance. We don't have to figure that whole puzzle out from Washington, and that's what's different. Is don't tell me it wasn't prescriptive. I mean, AYP, sure, there were elements that the states had to decide, but there was a lot of that said, we are not going to let you do accountability the way that you want to do it. Public school choice, supplemental services, we're going to mandate that you do these things. And guess what? The states and the districts didn't do it well because their hearts weren't in it.
Oh, so those are actually two different arguments. So that's right, their hearts weren't in it. So, I mean, that tells us something, that they really don't have all that much interest in making sure that poor kids in bad schools have alternative options. They would much rather be comfortable in many cases just trying to fix their low-performing schools that they go year and year and year after year trying to do. I mean, we have to remember that there is something I think flawed about the department's theory of action here. They honest to goodness believe that if we had a common measure, which they want to do through common standards and tests, and we can compare all states, that magically through shame and through transparency, we're going to be able to make all schools and all states better. Well, we've had that. It's called NAEP. We've had this for more than a generation. It's no mystery that Alabama isn't doing well and that Massachusetts is doing well. Shame and transparency are insufficient forces to make all schools and all states get better, so the common standards aren't going to get us there. And the truth of the matter is, we are giving 85-90% of schools back to states and districts with virtually no federal oversight, no real meaningful interventions, and there's nothing, I've seen absolutely nothing to convince me that most of these districts are going to get serious about low-performing schools in a way that they have been. I mean, it's hard for me to get excited about this.
Well said, but I can't give you the last word because I'm the host. All right, so two quick things, and then we'll be on. So first of all, I admit it. This is not going to fix all schools and all districts. I don't think there's anything the federal government can do to fix all schools and all districts, and we should admit that. And secondly, what this does do in terms of transparency is it's going to provide more honest feedback to parents. For an individual parent, we've been telling them for years, they get something sent home to them that says, your kid is proficient in reading and math. And they say, that sounds good. But guess what? In many states, that meant they weren't even at grade level, much less on track for college.
Can I just add on the note of agreement? So I think we agree that the federal government probably shouldn't be heavy-handed in education as a matter of principle. And the federal government, even when it tries to get involved in education, doesn't do all that good of a job. So in general, the philosophy the department's trying to go in, I think you and I agree, and I'll say I'm encouraged by it, but I just have a real hard time getting excited and celebrating, saying here are 85% of America's schools, ones that we knew weren't doing well before. Here, give them back to the states and districts who weren't doing well with them before.
Okay. Nicely played, Andy. All right, it's that time that everybody waits for all week long. It is Amber's Research Minute.
What up, Amber?
What up?
How are you?
We're talking ghetto today.
Andy, you know how I hate people talking over Amber's music.
I get so excited to see Amber because I love that song, and Amber and I don't get to talk that
yeah,
much.
That's right. Love fest up here.
So, Amber, I understand, to be honest, that we were kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel here this week.
Whew.
I mean, where are all the methodologically rigorous
studies?
I just
don't know, but I had a tough time, so just keeping it real today.
Is it just a function of spring, or?
I wish I knew, Andy.
Yeah, you should do a study and graph that. When is the best time for good studies to come out?
That would be interesting.
We should get the interns on that.
They're busy right now, but
working on your other projects.
Working on projects Rick should be working on for us, but anyway.
Rick has a big shadow here.
All right, what are we talking about today, Amber?
All right, this week we have a new study from the Center for American Progress on teacher evaluation in charter schools.
And by the way, the whole bottom of the barrel thing, I wasn't meaning that as a slur on the Center for American Progress. I just wanted to get that in there.
Good caveat.
Okay, yeah. To my friends at CAP.
Right. So it's a qualitative study of 5 charter schools from nationally recognized CMOs, so it's pretty limited in scope and scale and also does not include a comparison group. So, it's not a super-duper sophisticated design. That said, there are a few interesting findings. First, these charter schools engage teachers in critically reviewing their own practice, often on a weekly basis. There was a culture of self-critique and results-oriented teaching. Teachers often left weekly observations with a list of 3 tangible instructional areas they were to work on, so the focus was largely formative. Administrators even said that they hired teacher candidates based on their orientation to constructive feedback. That said, student performance contributed to the evaluations only in a qualitative way. None of the CMOs used value-added data to evaluate teachers, but did discuss student progress on school-based assessments. And few teachers were dismissed, even though most charter school principals have hiring and firing freedom. But this may, of course, be due to the fact that they hire high-quality teachers from the get-go. The implication overall was that charter school evaluations were less a rubber stamp affair than in traditional schools.
Okay, so what didn't you like about this study?
I just didn't like, I mean, I felt like they were kind of trying to carry the findings a little bit more, even though they said, oh, this is limited and it's a small scale, but yet nobody's ever done it before and it's really interesting new. And I really thought if you're going to make these comparisons to traditional schools, you need to have a comparison group of traditional schools.
Right.
That was a problem for them. They kept saying, well, you know, like most people say in traditional schools, they do it this way. But why not have 5 traditional schools? You know, right. I'm fine with case study research, but 9 times out of 10, if you don't have a comparison group, it makes life really difficult.
But this is pretty interesting. I mean, so these are the reform-minded charter school networks, mm-hmm. right? And yet they have not embraced looking at test scores to evaluate their teachers.
We don't know what CMOs they are, right?
Well, I have just put my little hat on. They give you hints.
Okay.
So they say there's a West CMO, and they give you the numbers, and blah, blah. I think it might be Aspire or Green Dot from the way they described it. The North one started with a seed school, blah, blah. They gave a couple hints. I think it's Achievement First.
Okay.
And then the other one, they said, gave you a bunch of hints. I think it's KIPP.
Okay, so these are the big names in the industry.
Yeah, so it's interesting and important that they don't feel that they want to embrace looking at test scores, per se, when evaluating teachers. I mean, I think that a lot of this conversation around teacher evaluation and merit pay and the obsession with making sure that test scores are a part of it mm-hmm. misses the whole point. I mean, I think what reformers should be for is letting principals make decisions, differentiate among teachers, use whatever good data they want to use, but not try to create some stupid formulas from the state or district level to put all teachers on some rubric,
right.
including test scores. That's just ridiculous, and we see that the really good schools aren't doing that.
That's right.
So was there anything about the study that really surprised you, that what they're doing differently or not doing differently?
Well, I thought, and this, and people hate this, and so do I, but it's just out there. It's the culture that they created, and we hear it so many times, but mm-hmm. it's a culture for teachers too. I mean, when principals talked about the few teachers they did let go, it wasn't because they were performing terribly. It was that they didn't play as a team player, and they weren't with the mission of the school. You know, it wasn't like, oh, you can't teach fractions, you know. And so I think that cultural piece is not only there for students and CMOs, which we hear a lot about, you know, we kind of, this paternalism thing, but there's a culture that they create for teachers as well. And if you're not with the culture, you're not a team player, you're out of there.
You know, that's actually really interesting, because if you kind of flip that over, now, as you say, we're getting obsessed with getting test scores in teacher evaluations. Maybe a lot of these great principals would say, that's pushing us in the wrong direction. I mean, you could actually imagine someday where a teacher will say, look, I have great test scores, my evaluation should be great, you shouldn't be able to fire me. And a principal will say, no, I want to fire you, you're not part of the team, you're not mm-hmm. leading to the culture of the school. Mm-hmm. And this reform era that we've kind of put in place with more data will actually inhibit us from doing the things we want, mm-hmm. which is allowing principals to make good decisions.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. All right, Amber. So what's the song that goes along with this one?
Since charter schools are changing the way typical teacher evaluations are presumably done, we have a deceased pop legend urging change in Man in the Mirror by Michael Jackson.
For the record, that's Mike. That's Mike. That's not me.
Better place. Take a look at yourself and make them. All right, I gotta say that. Wasn't that whole Amber's whole presentation was about how the charter schools aren't really making a change in their evaluations?
But they are looking in the mirror.
Oh, they do look in the mirror. That's right. They are self-critical. All right, Amber.
Whatever, it's
Amber's
Michael
defending.
Jackson.
Welcome, Stafford.
I know. I actually got to hear Amber's song today. It was very exciting.
Okay, but speaking of songs, it's time for the Rate That Reform song. Andy, thank you for not talking over the song. That was much appreciated.
I'm going to sulk now.
I talked before my song got played, so now our viewers know we switched chairs.
All right, Stafford, you had a great Rate That Reform last week. I can't remember what it was, but I loved it. So are you going to do it again this week?
I am. And this week, I would like to dedicate the Rate That Reform to Andy.
Awesome.
Well, you discovered this.
Okay.
So.
Oh, please.
So this is dedicated to Andy. Ah, Delaware. You thought you had it made, hiring a consultant, word on the street says it was McKinsey, maybe even getting some Gates funding for your efforts, though you weren't one of Gates' original 15. But then there's page 125. That's in section...
This of their Race to the Top.
Yes. The Race to the Top application.
Yes. I'm getting there.
Oh, sorry.
You ruined the punchline. And then there's page 125. That's in section D9, for those of you with your Race to the Top applications handy, where Delaware spells its name wrong. That's right, Delaware has two A's and two E's, not one A and three E's. And as Andy pointed out, on flypaper, ironies of all ironies, this is in the section on teacher effectiveness. You know, the part about improving the quality of teachers. Good luck with that. Let's maybe make sure they know how to spell the name of the state they teach in. For the record, it's Delaware, D-E-L-A-W-A-R-E.
Wow. So, Andy, you are the Race to the Top expert. Yeah. And so I want to know this. Out of the 500 points for the Race to the Top scoring, how many points can be taken away for this sort of misspelling?
Well, it's funny because it took place in the section that has the most points in it, the teacher quality section. But I laugh for a couple reasons. First, because I always spell Delaware wrong. I always make the same mistake. But Delaware appears something like, I did a search like 150 times in the document, and this was the one case where they got it wrong. So obviously, they either didn't spell check or they sent someone else to do this. But the fact is, they did have a consultant. They should have done this better. But the very funny thing is, when I posted this on flypaper, kind of making fun of them, I made the mistake of having a grammatical error in my own post about this.
Yes, and he confused its and its.
Yes, I forgot to put the apostrophe in its, so I think someone upstairs was getting back at me for being holier than thou and showed me that I shouldn't be snarky on flypaper, so I apologize.
See, I think if I'm a reviewer, this is a real conundrum because, you know, you want to take points off. On the other hand, I mean, who doesn't make the Delaware spelling mistake? And, you know, is it fair to give...
Oh, what do you mean, who doesn't make the Delaware spelling mistake?
E-A? I get it wrong all the time.
Good.
Too.
Thank
but,
you, Mike.
But it's not fair because a state like Ohio, I mean, you got to be really dumb to screw Ohio up, right?
I've just gone through so many of these awful applications and read all this jargon, so it's kind of nice to get a little bit of levity. Think, huh, they paid $250,000 for a consultant who can't even spell the name of the state right. Makes me feel better about my...
All right, well, to the extent that this is a reform staffer, what rate are you giving
it? I just want to tell Delaware and their consultants that you fail. You just fail. You fail at life. That's what you fail at.
Stafford's going to take some points off.
I got to be a nice guy. Of all the applications I've read, theirs is pretty good, even in this teacher quality section. They deserve some credit.
All right, well, if Delaware doesn't get funded, we all know why. It's because of Andy's flypaper post.
Oh, no.
That's all the time we've got for this week. Thanks, everybody, here for joining us. Till next week.
I'm Andy Smerick.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show here at edexcellence.net, signing off.